My guest at this time is Ed Whalen. He's the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center here in Washington. He also writes bench memos at National Review Online. Most significant for our conversation today is that Ed clerked for the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who of course died unexpectedly on Saturday. It's been a long few days for Ed, but he's gracious enough today to give us a few minutes to examine Scalia the man and his legacy in the law. And Ed, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.
Justice Scalia always referred to himself as a textualist when it came to evaluating laws in light of what the founders wrote down in the Constitution. What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, textualism is so common sense that it might puzzle people that there could be anything else. What a textualist does is looks at the text of the law to determine what the law means. But somehow in the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s, the left, not liking what the law actually said because it didn't sufficiently promote its own agenda, started reading all sorts of purposes into the law and adopted an approach that looked heavily to legislative history so it could manipulate the law to reach whatever result it wanted. So what textualism and originalism mean is that the judge's obligation is to construe the meaning of a legal provision as it was understood at the time that it was adopted, focusing on text, of course on context too. This isn't a hyper-literalism, but we look to the actual law, not to some presumed intent that we can concoct to lie behind the law.
One of the things I heard in another interview in the wake of Scalia's passing is that while most justices had their clerks doing interesting work, background research, writing things and so forth, Scalia loved to spar verbally and bounce ideas and understand what his clerks were thinking on different issues. What was it like for you in that circumstance with him?
Well, it was very intimidating, I think, for all of us young lawyers as we would sit in his chambers and discuss all the cases. I think we learned early on that he loved vigorous debate. He really wanted to make sure that he got things right, and the only way to do that was to really test them. Now, some of that was done orally. A lot, obviously, was done in writing. But you could just see him as he worked his way through problems. You could really see the muscles of his face move as his brain exercised. And then the wonderful aha moment when he reached clarity on a difficult legal issue.
Do you ever remember bringing the clarifying point to his attention?
Oh, boy, I'm not sure I'm responsible for that. I'd like to think that I drafted some good opinions. He always managed to make them better and make them distinctively his.
After almost 30 years, it could be very hard to choose just a couple of decisions which stand out as you think his best work, but which majority opinion or dissent stands out to you when you think back?
Well, I'll mention one majority opinion and two dissents, if I may. The majority opinion in the Second Amendment case from 2008 in Heller is a model of originalism. Justice Scalia got a majority of the court on board for his originalist approach there. Of course, some of them have wandered off in other cases when they haven't wanted to go where originalism would take them, but a very, very powerful reading of the Second Amendment. In terms of dissents, one that I will highlight is his dissent in 1988, his second full year on the court in the independent counsel statute case, Morrison versus Olson. He was alone in dissent, saying that that statute violated separation of powers. Years later, virtually everyone agrees with the wisdom of his dissent, and I am very hopeful that as the political controversies of the day pass, folks will increasingly see the wisdom of his other dissents. That would include the deep wisdom of his dissent in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, abortion case, where he said, look, this is a matter that the Constitution leaves to the political processes to decide, to democratic processes in each state. By taking this away from the people, by making this judicial power grab, you are corrupting the whole political process and extending the agony here. Justice Kennedy and the others in the majority pretended that they were resolving the issue for good. I think history has already shown that that judicial power grab hasn't silenced the defense of the unborn, and it won't. So he's I think been proven right there, though the majority hasn't yet accepted his wisdom.
In addition to the wisdom and the logic and the fidelity to the Constitution in these decisions, he also injected a lot of life into his legal opinions, whether in the majority or in the minority, often stinging rebukes of the opposing view, usually if he had written the dissent, but injecting humor into oral and written work as well. That's kind of different from most justices. What did you make of that?
Well, he loved language. He particularly loved using figures of speech or phrases that would really distill or capture exactly the point he was making. And I think what you find so often is that his colorful language isn't just excess, but it really focuses the mind on exactly what he's saying. Yes, you see that a lot in dissents. And what's interesting is you read so many of his dissents and look back and see, well, what did the majority have to say in response to that, and you discover that it said nothing because it had nothing to say. It ended up being the brute power of five justices or more deciding a case without engaging his counter-arguments. So I think that, that could have been, that was very frustrating at times. But again, he was writing for the ages, and I think generations from now, if we're lucky to have this republic survive that long, so long as people are reading Supreme Court decisions, they will savor Justice Scalia's opinions, both his majority opinions and his dissents.
Speaking of the ages, where do you think he does stack up among the great justices?
Oh, I think on any list of the top five, he's on the list. I don't see how it could be otherwise. John Marshall, I suppose... Justice Scalia loved Justice Robert Jackson. I'm not sure that I would put him in the same category. Obviously, in terms of influence for good or bad on the law, Justice Brennan and Chief Justice Earl Warren would belong on the list. Obviously, people may have different lists depending on what their criteria are, but in terms of brilliant legal analysis, Justice Scalia ranks right at the top.
We're talking with Ed Whalen, former clerk for Justice Scalia. He's now president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And Ed, just to close out on the personal side, in just the past couple of days, there's been so many stories about Scalia's good humor, his close relationships with people across the ideological spectrum. He never let the politics or legal disagreements get in the way of that sorts of thing. And just general kindness. There seems to be, even those who disagree with him strongly, great affection for the man. What moments personally or otherwise stand out to you from the personal side?
Sorry, I'm pausing as it's a question that just causes me to reflect on his many kindnesses to me. He was present at my wedding. I'm very grateful for that. He was just a generous mentor throughout my career. I really can't single out any moment. Whenever I needed sage advice, he was there, and I'm just deeply grateful to him.
Ed, I know it's been a difficult week, and it will continue to be difficult with his sudden passing. Thank you, sir, very, very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Ed Whalen is the president at the Center for Ethics and Public Policy in Washington. He writes bench memos at National Review Online, and he served as a clerk for the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.